Howdy and welcome to Thin Air News with an Altitude from Small Town Public Radio in the Rockies and Four Corners. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Gina Garacio. Howdy. This month in Durango, Christians disagree over homosexuality.
The enemy was very wise when he created homosexuality and its perversion.
In Telluride, you can be arrested for speech crimes.
And they handcuffed him in front of his children and took him away and put him in jail overnight. All for speech.
Aspen climbers bring help to classrooms in Nepal.
Now, they don't need computers because they don't have electricity.
But first, some news from around thin air country.
In a follow-up to last month's report on the Moab uranium tailings pile, there are new calls for groundwater treatment at the site to protect endangered fish species. For a new study, the U.S. Geological Service placed fish in submerged cages at various points where the Colorado River flows by the tailings. In some cases, the fish died immediately. The water contains uranium and many heavy metals, but the chief culprit is ammonia, which was routinely detected at levels 20 times higher than Utah drinking water standards. In New Mexico, opposition is rising to private prisons. The Cornell Corrections Corporation wants to house 2,000 illegal immigrants at the old state penitentiary. In Hobbs, Wackenhut Corrections wants to house 1,000 more at the county jail. The Santa Fe New Mexican is among those calling for a return to a public corrections system.
The Steamboat Springs City Council has exempted snow removal contractors from Steamboat's city noise ordinance. Residents have complained about snow plowing going on through the night, but operators say there's no other way to get business parking lots cleared by 7 a.m. or to maintain access to public buildings. In preparation for the 2002 Winter Olympics, U.S. West is building a new fiber optic network that will circle Salt Lake City, Provo, Park City, and Heber City. Many residents hope to benefit with new access to state-of-the-art communication lines, but many will only be tantalizingly close. In Park City, many of the region's 25,000 residents, even some in the city limits, will not be served by the new DSL lines. That's because, explains U.S. West, you have to be on the end of a line to central switching that is no longer than 3.5 miles. In Albuquerque, police are investigating a series of rapes on the University of New Mexico campus in which football players and fraternity members have been implicated. In the last few years, UNM has posted some of the highest crime rates among U.S. colleges. School officials say the numbers are misleading and that the campus is fairly safe.
This summer, a new study will be conducted in the Aspen Valley to see how hikers affect wildlife. The Aspen Wilderness Workshop is working with CU professor Rick Knight, whose previous studies have shown that hikers, especially hikers with dogs, can have a devastating effect on songbirds and mule deer. Mountain bikers who are facing proposed closures in the White River Forest are welcoming the prospect of more data on the subject. Meanwhile, the Forest Service is dropping its controversial plan to close East Maroon Creek Trail and to restore that area to pristine wilderness.
In Colorado, the debate continues over jobs and housing in rural and resort areas. Opponents of the White River Forest Plan say it will cost the area 5,000 jobs, but a study by regional governments says the same area faces an employee shortage that could hit 65,000. Some may take it for granted that Christian fundamentalists are unanimous about the evils of homosexuality, but we learn otherwise from Neil Collins, who files this report from Durango.
Homosexuality in the church. It's an issue that continues to be at the forefront of political and religious agendas nationwide, as both homosexual communities and fundamentalist Christian reactions to those communities grow, certain figureheads emerge at the center of the conflict. Christian recording artist Dennis Jernigan has gained prominence within the fundamentalist Christian community as a man who was once a homosexual but now condemns the lifestyle. Jernigan came to Durango on Saturday the 26th to share his music and his, quote, story of hope for the homosexual community.
Jesus.
just wasn't right. Something inside of me said it wasn't right, yet that was what seemed like to be my identity. So I thought, this is just who I am, and God must have made a mistake on me. And then what happened was that God showed me that he could change my identity, make me a brand new creation. And so in 1981, that happened, and I became a new creation and walked away from homosexuality once and for all.
Jernigan, who is now married to a woman and has 9 children, reflects on who exactly is behind homosexuality in America.
The enemy was very wise when he created homosexuality and its perversion. It's taking what is natural and using it in an unnatural way. And homosexuality, if you think about it, permeates all of society in this sense. The enemy knows that the sexual drive is a creative drive. God is creative. He's creator. He's made us creative. And if he can tap into the creativity of a society, I mean, think about it. Where do you see most homosexuality these days? It's in the arts. Yeah. The enemy was very wise in that. He knew that if he could pervert God's creativity, that creative drive in mankind, he could have a voice into society, and that's exactly what has happened in our nation.
Jernigan's view, however, is by no means held by all Christians, even here in Durango. Mark Devers, founder and pastor of the Inner Light Center, addresses the fundamentalist Christian focus on homosexuality as a sin.
What's so bad about an abomination? Now, what does that mean? My Bible says to me in the same books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy that it's an abomination to eat pork and to eat shellfish and to eat catfish. That is an abomination. All right, my same Bible says to me that it is also an abomination for a woman to wear a man's clothing. So how bad is an abomination? You see, that's where I think it's partly a political agenda on the part of the fundamentalists, because if they were really against this abomination thing in America, then they need to be picketing outside the barbecue place that serves pork, or they need to be picketing outside the catfish house. And the fact that the fundamentalist community chooses to ignore those verses and focus on something else really makes me question their integrity about this issue. If homosexuality is an abomination, well, fine. So is eating pork. What's the big deal here?
This issue often reaches beyond the religious realm and into that of the political. In the Christian Apologetics and Research Ministry article on Christianity and homosexuality, it is stated that, quote, should a woman be allowed to marry a woman? Should a man be allowed to marry another man? Should they be given legal protection and special rights to practice their homosexuality? No, 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 unquote. Feelings are strong on both sides of the issue, and as Jernigan shows us, so are the words.
When I discovered that Jesus Christ said he could give me a brand new identity, I decided I wanted that. And the question I would ask them is, if they had the choice to go back to their mother's womb, or the chance to go back to their mother's womb and choose whether to be gay or straight, what would they choose? And when I ask people that, they always, always say, I would choose to be straight.
Although at virtually the opposite end of the spectrum from Jernigan, Devers also feels strongly.
When the fundamentalist community seeks to create publicity, like those people protesting at the funeral of Matthew Shepard, carrying signs, that was very hurtful. Okay, that was very hateful. That's just the bottom line. And that kind of thing whips up bias against gay and lesbian people, perhaps in people who might not even notice or care otherwise. Okay, and yeah, it does affect spheres of influence outside of society or outside of the fundamentalist community. It makes people afraid. It whips up fear and bias and prejudice against people. And that's not loving.
Whether Durangoans are listening to Dennis Jernigan or attending Deaver's Inner Light Circle, perhaps the important thing to remember is that thoughts do have consequences. For Thin Air, this is Neil Collins.
Most people are familiar with the concepts of libel and slander. If someone says something bad about you, under certain conditions you can sue them and expect to win. But what if you could be arrested, jailed, and charged in criminal court for that same speech? Well, Colorado is one of the few states where that can happen. Twice in recent months, town marshals in Telluride have made arrests based on Colorado's rarely used criminal libel statute. One of the defendants is Steve Maskett, a California resident who owns a condo in Telluride. Maskett thought he was being ripped off by his local property manager. After losing a civil suit, he hung a large banner on his balcony proclaiming the property manager was a crook, Maskett's defense attorney Bob Korn.
Well, then after they seized the banner with a search warrant, then they issued an arrest warrant for criminal libel, accused my client, Mr. Maskett, of a felony, and they handcuffed him in front of his children and took him away and put him in jail overnight. All for speech.
In the second case, Telluride resident Al Heirich was charged with criminal speech on the internet. The alleged victim was a local woman. Heirich had posted a message on a chat site purporting to be from the woman. It said in part, "I and my younger sister are into lesbian incest and are looking for partners." Again, the defense attorney is Bob Korn, who is arguing in district court that while Heirich's message was the work of an immature and insensitive mind, it is protected speech.
Of course, the internet is so new to all of us, and new to the federal Congress, and new to the U.S. Supreme Court, and new to Janet Reno. And one of the things that is important with the internet is to keep it free and unfettered and unregulated by the government.
Korn cites court precedent that humor, fantasy, opinion, and rhetorical hyperbole cannot be limited in speech, whether it is outrageous or not. Jerry Falwell lost a suit with Hustler magazine over a story that said Falwell had a drunken, incestuous rendezvous with his mother in an outhouse. A former Miss Wyoming failed to get a judgment against Penthouse magazine for a story about a fictional Miss Wyoming. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Louisiana law after famed District Attorney Jim Garrison was prosecuted for saying local judges were inefficient and lazy. The Court of the Land ruled that under modern conditions it can hardly be urged that the maintenance of peace requires a criminal prosecution for private defamation. Attorney Korn says the courts have been consistent that satire, parody, and opinion are protected speech regardless of the perceived tastelessness of the subject matter.
The criminal libel statute is a very unusual statute in the state of Colorado. It's hardly ever invoked because it's not just a statute which imposes criminality on speech. It involves the First Amendment also. So unlike a larceny statute or a sexual assault statute, which is clearly an illegal action and a violation of another person, this is something which criminally punishes speech.
Telluride Chief Marshal Jim Kolar defended his use of the criminal libel statute.
Obviously, there's a First Amendment issue with people being allowed to exercise their freedom of opinion and speech. In some cases, that might seem to go overboard and actually libel a person's reputation. I think you have to look at the circumstances in each instance and determine, you know, from an investigative standpoint, whether you think there was some malicious intent involved or if it was merely someone exercising their freedom of opinion. You consult with the DA's office over those issues and try to strike a balance as to whether or not you think you've crossed over into the realm of criminal conduct or whether it's not something that could be remedied through civil recourse.
At the American Civil Liberties Union office in Denver, Mark Silverstein expressed surprise that criminal libel cases are being filed in Telluride.
We believe that it's not constitutional. We also think it's bad public policy and that nobody should be threatened with prison for what they say or what they write. I mean, I've probably been in Colorado almost 2 years in this job without even knowing that there was such a statute on the books. This is the sort of statute that most people who are familiar with First Amendment law believe that these statutes fell into disuse years ago.
Silverstein said, in fact, the ACLU is looking for the right case to try and overturn Colorado's law.
It has the potential to create a tremendous chilling effect on expression, that individuals can be threatened with felony charges simply for what they say or what they write is remarkable. It prohibits expression that many people commonly engage in all the time.
Back in 1991, the state Supreme Court struck down part of Colorado's criminal libel statute. The case involved a Denver resident who was picketing the Mark Toyota Volvo dealership with a sign that said, "Consumer, beware, engine might need to be replaced in 3 years without help from this dealership." Again, the court backed up 60 years of rulings that say free speech cannot be subject to prior restraint merely because it is alleged to be defamatory.
It makes it a crime to blacken the memory of one who is dead.
The Colorado law goes on to say, it shall be a felony to impeach the honesty, integrity, virtue, or reputation, or expose the natural defects of one who is alive, and thereby to expose him to public hatred, contempt, or ridicule.
Talk about a statute that has the potential to be unconstitutionally vague, or if it means what it says, then it covers all manner of common everyday expression. You can read newspaper articles that blacken the memory of individuals who are dead. You can read newspaper articles that point out the defects of individuals who are alive.
As far as the Telluride cases, Mr. Maskett still faces up to 90 days in jail for hanging out his banner. Mr. Heirick, the boorish chat room participant, pled to a lesser charge of computer harassment. A county judge ruled that Heirick should give up all but his business uses of the Internet. And Chief Kolar says Telluride cops will continue to charge citizens with speech violations.
You may not be charged that frequently, but you know, certainly if the circumstances warrant it, the charges may be brought. You know, the fact of the matter is there still is a section of the revised statutes that speaks to criminal libel, and it's still a valid statute on the books.
It's all small town talk. Don't pay it any mind. Don't believe a word.
You're listening to Thin Air. What do two mountain climbers from Aspen, a Chicago high school, three sporting goods stores, and a 23,000-foot Himalayan peak have in common? Marilyn Gleason reports from KAJX in Aspen.
All are connected to a Chicago business owner named Don Warsham. Warsham owns Active Endeavors, a chain of stores selling sporting goods in Chicago, Boulder, and Santa Fe. A climber himself, Warsham has used his business to spin off a nonprofit called Connecting Classrooms to the World. The organization launched its latest endeavor, which will bring a team of 7 climbers and 7 teachers to Nepal in April and May. Bob Slozen, a climbing guide and ski instructor from Aspen, will lead the climbing team on Pomori, a 23,500-foot peak a stone's throw from Mount Everest. Heidi Close is a guide for Aspen Expeditions and the second Aspenite on the journey. Other climbers come together from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Bozeman, Montana, Chicago, and Nepal. Slozen is a veteran Himalayan climber.
His wife is a school teacher. They are connected with some schools, some underprivileged schools in Chicago.
Warsham used the expedition to leverage a $125,000 technology grant for Cesar Chavez Academy, a high school on Chicago's south side. Don Warsham.
We partner up with one individual school in the U.S. and one school in whatever country we're visiting. We figure out what those schools need. This year, we adopted the Cesar Chavez School on the south side of Chicago, which is about as poor a community as you can find, where you go through metal detectors to go to class every day. They didn't have any computers, so we worked with IBM and got them 40 laptops donated. In Nepal, we're working with two schools, the Jewal Boarding School and a public school in Ringmo, and we will actually stop at those two schools along the way and deliver them school supplies. Now, they don't need computers because they don't have electricity, so we're bringing them pens, papers, chalkboards, whiteboards, erasers, school books, all of which have been donated by neighboring schools here in Chicago, in Santa Fe, and in Boulder.
The third educational aspect employs a satellite phone and the Internet to let U.S. students participate in the expedition from afar. Slozen is familiar with satellite phones from his previous Everest climbs.
You just simply dial a number and it beams off a satellite and it comes right over to the web here, or a phone system, our phone systems here in the States, in the Western world, and we can communicate via satellite. Of course, it needs some power, so we have some batteries. We'll have solar panels with us.
A web page builds daily lesson plans around the expedition. Students study culture, geography, human physiology, language, geology, and more along the trail to the high Himalaya. But what captivates Worsham most is the power of letting children communicate with each other across the globe.
My ultimate goal is to have, for lack of a better word, Joey in Nepal talk to Sally in Chicago or Boulder or Aspen or Washington, and for them to be able to email each other. That's been our mission last year also, as we stopped in individual places last year by using satellite phone and a laptop and a solar charger. We put kids in villages that, again, had never seen a computer before on the Internet, talking with kids the same age in other parts of the world.
The trekkers and climbers left for Nepal on April 1st. After assembling gear and porters in Kathmandu and a flight to Paplu, the 80-mile trek commenced with visits to schools in an area less traveled by Western tourists. Slozen allowed 2 weeks to reach the foot of Everest in Pumori. There, at an elevation near 18,000 feet, a base camp would be established. Here, lessons address high-altitude topics, and climbers begin building tolerance to the altitude and establishing ever-higher base camps on the slopes of Pumori. It will take 16 to 18 days to reach the summit of Pumori through this process. In the weeks before departure, unplanned circumstances continue to surprise Worsham and demand revisions. He seemed to take them in stride.
Just in the last 48 hours, we've had phone calls from Nepal warning us that the Maoists are going to have an armed insurgency general riot on the 6th of April, which is our scheduled date to fly from Kathmandu to Paplu, where we begin our trek and actually where we visit our first school.
By mid-May, the trekkers expect to complete their journey, and most will be ready to head home. Meanwhile, you can track their progress, ask questions, and join in the learning by logging on to the website at activeendeavors.com, then clicking on to Basecamp. For Thin Air, I'm Marilyn Gleason.
This month, Connie Gotch once again has her eye on the four corners with a look at the Mozart effect on Farmington students.
Music enhances creativity, learning power, and social skills, or so the psychologists say. This past March, America celebrated Music in the Schools Month. In Farmington, students at all grade levels gathered one weekend in a local mall to concertize. They showed that music has many uses for the growing up years. Apache Elementary pupils put on a show with their vocal music instructor, Miss Planning. She teaches kids like Autumn to use music to develop a sense of fun.
We're learning how to sing. It inspires us to do music.
Mainly at the elementary, I have a lot of support that I want the children to enjoy the songs, to enjoy the music, so I try to present a variety. It's important to get a love of music at this age.
But as young musicians mature, the fun gets more serious and the demands of music tougher. Director of Farmington's Hermosa Junior High School Band, Les Leach, is preparing a wind transcription of one of Bach's preludes and fugues for the group to take to district contest. He faces the crowd that has gathered to hear the ensemble.
The next piece is kind of a work in progress. This is a very challenging piece of music. We may even have to stop it if we have a problem, but I hope you'll not mind that. I think it's important for the students to be challenged at every level and every time. We hope you enjoy the Prelude and Fugue.
The band plays the piece slowly but accurately. Mr. Leach does not have to stop them.
We're taking it at a fairly slow tempo. It should move along much quicker than it does. But my whole theory of teaching is to be sure that the students play slow enough that they can play it accurately, and then they won't have to relearn any of the mistakes that they learn if they play it too fast.
But playing in the band teaches more than just correcting musical mistakes. Percussionist Deanna Lee.
When you play with people, you have to play with everyone, and so it like makes you have involved with everybody.
As we look more and more at the opportunities that students have, when they fill out applications, job applications, applications to become involved at a university, we are finding out that more and more administrations and managers of stores are looking very carefully at the people who are involved in music activities, because they are discovering that people who have that kind of background are team players. They're used to having to pull things together as a group. And one of the neat things that I always point out to the students is that there are no bench warmers in a band, orchestra, or a choir. Everyone in the whole group must play their part.
Music can also teach about other cultures. To play a piece called Japanese Festival, the Hermosa Junior High Band had to learn the pentatonic scale. This challenged Deanna Lee.
But it's the different notes that you use, like you don't use certain notes on Japanese Festival.
They seem to enjoy it a lot. They were interested, I think, in finding out what it is. I think they knew that the sound was different, but they did not know why. So we talked about the musical structure of the music and how it's put together. And as they came to understand it, now I've also told them that they can actually improvise around that pentatonic scale, and it makes everything fit together. They can make up melodies of their own, just leaving out those notes.
Deanna Lee plans to play percussion all her life. While she hasn't chosen a college yet, she's considering New York University in New York City. She's found playing music enhances her ability to listen to music.
When I hear songs, I hear like I see myself like playing to them, like when I play the drums and stuff, like my foot tapping and stuff like that. So I notice more instruments like drumming and percussion-wise and stuff.
Learning life skills by playing music, this time in Farmington, New Mexico, but wherever young people perform in bands and choruses. March is Music in the Schools Month each year, but what young musicians learn by playing and singing lasts a lifetime. For Thin Air, I'm Connie Gotch in Farmington, New Mexico at KSJE-FM.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is brought to you by the High Country Community Radio Coalition.
Funding comes from your local station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In Durango, Christians disagree over homosexuality.
The enemy was very wise when he created homosexuality and its perversion.
In Telluride, you can be arrested for speech crimes.
And they handcuffed him in front of his children and took him away and put him in jail overnight.
Aspen climbers bring help to classrooms in Nepal.
Now, they don't need computers because they don't have electricity.